much of what we see and we think is just black and white, solid or gas in front of us is an interpretation based on incomplete data, based on our mental model of the world. Most people don't appreciate that your brain changes based on experiences, but that an experience does not have to be something in the real world. An experience can be fiction. An experience can be something you worry about, news that you read. Even fantasies are mental events that shape the hardware that your new information flows through. How you think about your brain and how you think about yourself is such an important layer that we add to our experiences that drives our decisions and our behavior. And I think understanding how to partner with your brain and how your brain partners with technology, this has got to be the key to getting ready for the future.
I'm Misha Da Vinci. This is The Grift Podcast, conversations with founders, technologists, scientists, researchers, authors, and experts to distill the newest information, smartest ideas, and best practices to get you ready for the very different future we are already living in. If we are going to adapt and succeed in an AI-dominated world where technological change happens at an exponential rate that we cannot even imagine, we will need to understand how our brains work and learn to use them differently. My guest today is going to help us do that. Chantelle Pratt is a cognitive neuroscientist doing interdisciplinary research investigating the biological basis of individual differences in cognition. She is a professor at the University of Washington in the departments of psychology, neuroscience, and linguistics, and at the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, the Center for Neurotechnology, and the Institute for Neuroengineering. Chantelle's work has been supported by the National Institute of Health, the Office of Naval Research, and the Keck Foundation. She's featured in the documentary, I Am Human, and her studies have been profiled in Scientific American, Psychology Today, Science Daily, Rolling Stone, Popular Mechanics, Pacific Standard, Travel and Leisure, National Public Radio, and others. She's the author of The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different, and How to Understand Yours. This is a massively important conversation that I'm so excited to share with you. It will completely change how you think about your brain, yourself, and your prospects in life. Let's dive in and get ready for the future. Chantelle, hi. Thanks so much for coming on. I'm so excited to chat with you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
You're a cognitive neuroscientist. What exactly does that mean? What are you actually studying?
I'm really interested in how the human brain makes sense of the world, and specifically how different human brains have different sense-making system and how that scales up to the way we think, feel, and behave uniquely.
Normally on this podcast, I'm talking about the future, technology, how the world's changing, because I'm really concerned that a lot of things are happening that people are not aware of, don't understand, and will struggle to adapt to. And I think that you're important to this conversation, and a neuroscientist can add to this conversation because you understand the human brain. And the human brain, if we're thinking about technology, is like our own little or not so little computer that's on top of our heads that's sort of running the whole show. First of all, is that a fair sort of assessment of the brain?
Ish. I think like, yes, in that it's our sense-making system, right? It's taking inputs and it's making calculations and it's using these calculations to predict the future, which is exactly what this podcast is about. But also, we're different than machines. We're biological, right? Like, unlike a computer, our experiences, real and imagined, change the shape of us. We're biological information processing machines, and so we grow and change.
I think what happens is as we become familiar with technology, it's sort of a great sort of an analog for us to sort of understand our own
the way we think and the way we function and the way we make mistakes or don't make mistakes. So mm-hmm. a few mm-hmm. references in there. But you're an expert on the brain. And I think that mm-hmm. people need to understand their brains if they're going to make sense of the changing world and adapt to it. Maybe with so much changing around us, maybe our brain is the part of us that if it changed or if we learned to use it better, we would be able mm-hmm. to become more? I don't know. I'm hoping to find some answers, which is all of this to say, this is why you're on the podcast, Chantel.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think you're right. And I think that understanding how to partner with your brain as, you know, hopefully we'll get to this place in our conversation, but how you think about your brain and how you think about yourself is such an important layer that we add to our experiences that drives our decisions and our behavior. And I think understanding how to partner with your brain and how your brain partners with technology, how they're the same and how they're different. I mean, I think this has got to be the key to getting ready for the future.
Very
humble opinion.
Yes. And I would completely concur. Because we can only adapt so much to what's external, but I think so mm-hmm. a big piece of the puzzle is us learning to understand ourselves and how to actualize ourselves, and understanding the brain is this, like it's this black box on top of our heads in so many ways. We don't really know what's going on in there. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. if we did, maybe something much greater would happen with us. Because I think as humans, we are not even close to what our potential is as humans. Like, not even close. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that from the way that people think, oh, we only use 10% of our brain or whatever. I think that's not true. That's
very not true.
Right. Okay. So it's more like there's so
what
much,
are you using it for?
There's so the, much more the, to us. You know, we need to change our relationship with our brain. And in mm-hmm. order to do that, we need to understand what it is and then understand how to use it. Enter mm-hmm. Chantel Pratt, cognitive neuroscientist, overall genius, awesome human, and you're going to walk us through this.
Oh my gosh, no big deal. Introducing you to your brain.
Yay! Yes! I love it! Oh my gosh! Okay, so, but before we get into that, Chantel, tell us a little bit about you. Like, who are you? How did you get to become this person that you are today? This, might I add, frankly, delightful human that I see on my screen who is so warm and kind and awesome.
Oh my gosh. When I hear you say stuff like that, I'm like, I should just stop and not ruin any preconceived notions. Well, thank you. I would love to believe that I'm a person who lives with her arms wide open. And so I'm glad that you feel that. There are a lot of scary, changing things and what makes me is the desire to understand each person as a unique and important contribution to the world and get to a place where even if there's somebody I vehemently disagree with, I can understand why their brain makes the choices that they make, given the way that that person was built and the environment that that person adapted to. That's my goal in life.
And at this point in where we are on humanity's journey to wherever, that is mm-hmm. such a necessary approach to self mm-hmm. and others. It is so important. And I think the rest of us seeing life and the world through your lenses is going to be massively helpful. So how did you become this person?
Well, I think I grew up a little weird. I mean, and I say that, you know, celebrating all of our differences. I grew up in the 80s and we had the Breakfast Club and there was the stoner and the jock and the, you know, all these categories of people. And I hung out with all of them and I was none of them. Hmm. I was just kind of an observer of these different groups and different ways that people behaved in a non-judgmental, curious way. Hmm. I started, my career, I wanted to be a medical doctor. And I think that this was something that I just decided was an important, successful profession. And I wanted to understand human beings through this biological lens. And I needed a single social science class to complete my pre-med prerequisites, my medical school prerequisites, and I took psychology just by convenience and realized that I had been studying all these organs and the way the lungs oxygenate your blood and the heart pumps this oxygenated blood through the body. And then you have this brain that takes oxygenated blood and turns it into every thought, feeling, and behavior that you identify with as yourself. And that if you change that organ, you change yourself.
Yes.
And that was it for me. It was like lightning strike. I thought like, oh, this is, it's not like the whole body. I mean, I do care about the whole body, but it's just that. It's the brain. It's the way the brain gives rise to you that I need to understand. And so it was a swift pivot into understanding the brain, not only the brain, but the human brain, which is probably among, if not the most complicated systems that we can understand as humans. You're stuck in this loop because it's the brain trying to understand itself. And if our brains were simple enough to understand, we would be not intelligent enough to understand them.
Wow.
You know, so it's a process. I feel very much like I'm still on that journey to understanding how our brain gives rise to us.
I love that. So while you were talking, an idea popped in my brain, and it was sort of this. So technology is the conversation that's top of mind. Artificial intelligence, everybody's talking about. And there's this whole idea of artificial general intelligence and the singularity when computers themselves will be able to think. And some people think even have consciousness. I disagree vehemently with that idea. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolute nonsense. But you, as a scientist, I'm not a scientist. I'm a pro-human person. I'm a person who's fighting for the survival of humanity, human values, human flourishing in a world all about, let's control humanity with machines. And a few people will control the entire world, everything we think, everything we do, what we believe is fact. There are those people who would love to do that. And whether they or not they start off with that intention, the more power they accrue, the more inclined they are to fall off the deep end and become evil. Because we know the nature of power corrupts humanity. Power corrupts a human. That's just, very few people can withstand the seductive power of power. So so everything we talk about, I think it was within the context of these forces that are at play currently. Some people think, some people say machines will have consciousness. I say, bollocks, you're the expert. In your studies of the human brain, is there anything that suggests that there is a consciousness that is apart from the physical, this biology of the brain? Is there an energy that enters the brain upon birth and exits the brain upon death?
It's so interesting because, like everything, people who have an opinion up front can slide around the definition of things to conveniently match what is consciousness and what is this. And
that's right.
And this is far from my area of expertise, but I do believe that what we experience as consciousness is directly related to the state of our brains. And I think that we have some better research that looks recently that looks at, for instance, people under anesthesia. And, you know, there are, we are developing tools for understanding the phenomenon. So you're saying, is it an energy that you're born with? And then goes away when you die. I think it's a particular brain. It's the way we experience. It's the qualia. It's the way we experience.
I guess the question
state
is,
of our brain.
Is soul a thing? Is consciousness as a soul, as a non-physical energy a thing?
What I can say is if that's – what I can say very honestly and very transparently is that if that's true, it would be a hard thing to answer from a scientific
point
perspective. Because if it's a thing
– yeah.
It's invisible and hard to measure or possibly impossible.
So the next question is, can a machine mimic a brain, the human brain, to the point where it can have actual consciousness?
I think no.
Why?
Again, because the computer is not a biological machine. It doesn't have – its states are very limited. I think it can mimic human behavior.
Yes, agreed.
But there's no independent – thought or even an there's no reason to think it experiences that in any way.
It's not sentient.
Right.
So what do you say to these scientists and AI researchers who very much like to believe that it, that their baby that they're creating in their lab can actually feel things?
I guess what I guess what this really speaks to is the power of storytelling in the human brain, right? And that's what it goes back to is that we interpret. I mean, I think that the most important job of all of our brains is to add a whole bunch of interpretation with incomplete data. I think the biggest story our brain tells us is to reduce the uncertainty that's available at every level, from perception to conception to decision. Yeah. And so, you know, we're all doing that all the time, from deciding whether a dress is blue and black and or white and gold, to like political affiliations, to how you interpret what it means to be alive, what it means to have a spirit or to have a decision-making independence.
So that anthropomorphizing of AI is something that as humans, we are imbuing the machine with.
We do this, right? We do this. And it's so, you know, I'm an animal lover. I have horses and rabbits and dogs, and I just got ducks. So I love interacting with animals, and we anthropomorphize animals, but we also, even in connecting with other humans, just the fact that we're social primates, we use mirror neurons to understand other things. Like, you know, and then a computer is like a very far extension, but we've developed these things to look like, to interact with us. We've developed them to interact with us. A great example of this is some work we're doing in the lab right now that shows that learning to program computers in modern programming languages looks very similar to learning a natural language. So if we want to predict who will be good at learning to talk to computers, these languages have evolved to interface with humans, right? So we're creating the tool in our image, and we're understanding it. And so, you know, it's just like, if this is your baby, you use the word, this is your baby, right? Yeah. And so we do that. We create meaning. We're storytellers.
Yeah.
And so that's the way we understand that.
Yeah. So we're in a bit of a loop here. We can't really get outside of our brains in order to see our brains, or we can't really get outside of ourselves in order to objectively see ourselves. Because even when we study our brain, we're still giving the meaning from the study from our brains. Kind of weird.
That's right.
All right. We're going to get into that.
I wish people could see you grabbing your head right now. Keep your brains from leaking out of your ears as we try and like
I know.
Process the bigness
so
of it
all. It's so exciting. It's so cool. The book's so delicious, by the way. I love it.
Thank you. It's a great book.
I really want people to read it. You've done such a brilliant job of taking this topic that's really not easy and really communicating to us, to the layperson, in a way that was so accessible and available and really got me thinking about my brain in a very easy, natural way. I was like, wow, I understand that now. I understand that. All of this stuff. And I just, great job.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I like to know a little bit more about my guest. So day in the life of Chantel, how does it work?
Oh my gosh. Well, I could tell you an average day or an ideal day, but I would say that I feel successful when I have spent some amount of time learning. Mm. I try and learn something every day. It's so easy to spend a day on email and tasks, but like I would like to spend some amount of time learning, reading other articles, you know, learning from other scientists. I would like to spend some amount of my day creating, and that's really hard, thinking about the perfect time, the perfect space to be creative, really hard to do under pressure. Some amount of my day communicating, teaching or working with others, communicating with others, moving my body in nature. That's very good for my brain.
Yeah.
I moved during the pandemic out to a 2.5-acre farm in the suburbs of Seattle.
Oh,
so
that's
that makes
amazing.
It on my non-commuting to work days, that makes it much easier to get out and move my body in nature. I have a lab. I co-direct it with my husband, which is kind of adorable and kind of disgusting, depending on where you fall on the spectrum.
I think it's adorable.
It's great for us. We're about to go through our 15th year of marriage, and it's so great to sit across the table with somebody who has a similar lens on the world and on people that you do, but we have very different processing styles. He is very systems level modeling. I'm very like individual level, communicative language. Yeah. And our students really benefit from having the kind of two-headed monster that, you know, cares about each other and them equally well and get our different perspectives. But like, for instance, when it comes to understanding others, like one of the things I find most fascinating about my husband is he thinks entirely visually. He does not have auditory thought. His consciousness, you were talking about consciousness. His consciousness, he says, is like Netflix on mute or PowerPoint slides. I just have a running voice in my head.
Oh, wow. That must be so cool for you as brain scientists to have this entirely different way of operating and to just to know from your own lived experience that there are two entirely different ways of looking at this same situation. How cool is
that? That's right. It's very cool. I like it. My life experience experiment.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on having this lovely relationship and this work and life. And I just perfect. Good for you. Okay. So we were a day in the life of Chantel. I think we got the general picture.
Yeah.
What excites you? What, when you get up in the morning, what drives you? What is that motivating force for you or inspiring force for you?
I think I feel really inspired when I can help someone get to know themselves through my lens. And I think not only get to know themselves, but get to appreciate themselves. I think there are a lot of things that we feel are limitations, like forgetting, you know, what we pay attention to, so forth and so on, that are really exist for a reason. And I think that if you can start to understand why your brain does what it does, you can more deeply appreciate why you are the way you are. And I love that. That excites me.
Do you think enough people know enough about, as humans, do we understand our brains at all? Or is this an area where we have so much to learn?
Both. I think both. I think we understand more and more about the human brain and about brains in general, but it's so complex. And I think even understanding individual differences kind of blows up this complexity. And now people are starting to like understand neurodiversity and embrace the way brains work in this kind of typical, atypical fashion. But still, I think that, you know, part of my job and the work that I do is getting people to appreciate that this one size fits all view of how brains work doesn't fit anybody very well, and that the truth is more complicated, that there are these series of trade-offs that brains take in trying to understand, you know, here we are. You know, you're very thoughtful about how the world is changing and adapting faster than we can keep up with it. But here we are we have a magnificently complicated biological contained brain, and it exists in this infinite universe that is constantly changing, and we're taking snapshots of it and trying our best to understand the world out there. And so there are trade-offs, you know, that we make. It's not possible to understand the world as it is. And if it were, it wouldn't be functional. Like, there are a whole lot of things about the world that actually quite don't really matter for your existence. Yeah.
We don't want to know about that. It'll take up too much space.
Right. Okay. That's right.
So there are some parts of the brain we need to understand. And I picked three and I want you to tell us what they are. I think the amygdala, which you don't really talk a lot about in the book, but I think people are familiar with. So tell us what that is.
Mm-hmm. The amygdala is an almond-shaped area of the brain that lives right next to our hippocampus, which is part of the memory-making and explicit memory-making systems that help us to anchor ourselves in a particular point in time in our history. And the amygdala is very sensitive to threats and to fight or flight responses. The fact that it's neighboring the hippocampus is really important because if it senses something unusual or particularly dangerous, for instance, it ramps up the memory making systems. Like, I need to notice what's happening right now because this is potentially important for survival.
Right. There's the prefrontal cortex.
Yes.
Again, most people are familiar with that term, but what is it?
Ish. So like, it's funny because the prefrontal cortex is a lot of brain. It's just basically everything that is in front of our motor systems. And And, you know, at the sort of more frontal you go, the more evolutionarily new this part of the brain is. I think it's really important to know that the prefrontal cortex is kind of like the control center or the engineer of your brain. It has a lot of converging information from all of the other parts of the brain that it uses to kind of titrate incoming information and help guide you through the world. The prefrontal cortex is energetically really expensive. It uses a lot of the glucose in your brain, and it allows you to override more automatic responses when you find yourself in a situation that you need to behave flexibly. Like, I usually do this, but now in this circumstance, that's not appropriate. Or I really want this thing, but I know that if I wait, there's something better in the future. So the prefrontal cortex is kind of like the governor of the brain.
And is that the part that responds to caffeine? Because
it all responds to caffeine a little bit. Yeah.
Speaking of caffeine. Okay. Same. And then there's
the cheers.
it's my one addiction. And then there's
gives
the basal ganglia
too.
Right? The basal ganglia. Mm. Which you talk a lot about in the book.
Yeah.
Tell us about the basal ganglia. What is it? Where is it?
Yeah, I think the basal ganglia are the unsung heroes of the brain. It's actually a series of little nuclei that live near the center of the brain. And I like to think of this like if the prefrontal cortex is the CEO of the brain, if it's the place that sort of sets the goals and then calls the shots according to these goals, the basal ganglia are listening to the prefrontal cortex's goals, and they are filtering information coming in through sensory and associative cortical areas accordingly. So it's like, oh, your goal is graduate from college. Okay, we're going to help you resist the desire to do this and instead let you study. Or your goal is notice when there's something new in the visual world. We're going to help you by turning down information in the auditory world. So the basal ganglia are weighting signals. They're prioritizing the massive amounts of incoming signals in the brain according to what they believe your prefrontal cortex's goal is. And it sends turned up or turned down signals to the prefrontal cortex so that kind of the CEO of the brain gets information that the basal ganglia thinks is going to make you be successful given that goal, given the state that you're in, given what it is that you want to accomplish.
So prefrontal cortex sets the goal. Basal ganglia then feeds prefrontal cortex information it believes prefrontal cortex needs in order to achieve goal.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Okay.
And I think this is like, you know, just to kind of let you, I mean, this is very important for selective attention, for filtering, and for flexible behavior. They take information from everywhere and then turn up or turn down that information according to what it thinks it is that your definition of success is, what it is that you're trying to accomplish.
So the will of the human is predominant. The desires of the human reign supreme.
Correct.
And then
in that state.
Okay. Here's what I want to do. Love the book, took away so much from the book. But when I was sort of prepping for this, I was like, how do I approach this? You know, you can go through chapter by chapter. You can do a lot of different ways if you want to talk about a big topic with an author. I want to just look at the things that stuck out in my brain as really important. And then use that as jumping off points. And then you can go wherever you want with it. So first point, every brain is different. And we all need to learn the peculiarities of our unique brain and how to use it. Fair? Mm-hmm. Is that a fair point to take from the book?
It's very fair and accurate. According to everything I know, lived and learned, this is the truth. Our brains are all different, not only different from one another, but even different from ourselves in the past and different from ourselves in the future, right?
Ooh. So our brains are changing all the time based on experiences?
That's right. And I think that most people don't appreciate that your brain changes based on experiences, but that an experience does not have to be something in the real world. an experience can be fiction. An experience can be something you worry about. Experience can be something, you know, news that you read. Everything that creates a mental, a conscious experience changes your brain, and that your brain then uses that data as its way of understanding what is happening in the real world.
So true information, fake information, fiction, stories, ideas, virtual reality experiences, all of this can imprint and shape our brain, change our brain.
This is correct, yes. Even fantasies and what you worry about, you know, even the kind of things that you, when you're mind wandering, those things are mental events that shape the hardware that your new information flows through.
Wow. So we're constantly, our brains are constantly changing, and we are constantly changing our brain by what we pay attention to or what we spend time on with our minds, what we focus on. Our brain,
that's right.
It's such a loop, though. Yeah. It's such a loop.
Right. But the thing to note is it is a loop, right? Because it's like, at what point do I intervene on this, my brain attention thing? But I think that's where awareness comes in, and this frontal lobe comes in, because learning about, you know, you can, and in fact, we do. There's a part of our brain that Michael Gazzaniga called the interpreter that just watches us behaving through the world and then tells us a story about why we're doing the things we're doing.
Part of the prefrontal cortex.
That's right. Yeah. And so that awareness, like when you then develop the tools to reverse engineer yourself, you're giving that part of your brain that interprets things more data. It's like educating the interpreter. And I think that, so you become aware of you watch yourself go through the day, you become aware of your behaviors, and you say, like, what is this preparing me for? You know, what is this worry, or what is this book I'm reading, or what is this show I'm watching? What is it actually preparing me for?
So our brains are super malleable, and they're being shaped and reshaped by whatever they're exposed to at all times. As humans, we need to be aware of this, understand this, and then learn how to take care of our brains so that they become the kind of organ or system that we desire rather than something that we don't. Accurate?
Correct. Okay. Yes.
All right. One of the key points that stuck out to me was what you just said. Our brains make stuff up. They fill in information that they think should be there. Our brain is always telling us a story, creating meaning depending on other, like, contextual information.
Mm-hmm. That is right.
Tell us more.
Yeah. So our brain is a massive information generator. You know, we perceive the world like our eyes are movie cameras. You know, it looks like we're looking through a lens. We are. But, you know, through the lens, what we're really getting is just pixelated, massively downsampled information about the world. We're getting discrete, bite-sized chunks of the world, and we're filling in the blanks to kind of create this sense of moving through with much more certainty and information than we really have. And we do this based on a huge amount of statistics that our brains take based on our previous experiences, again, lived and imagined. Our brains are always generating hypotheses about what must be going on right now based on what we've experienced in the past. And that is a way of getting stuck, really. It really is a way of getting stuck, because it, you know, with more and more of the same kinds of information, like the more similar your experiences are to one another, the more entrenched, the more your brain says, oh, this must be happening.
That is what
always happens.
So that's a belief then that we mm-hmm. believe this is a fact. This is real. This is what it is. This interpretation is indeed a truth.
Right. Well, there are different levels of this inference making, right, that go all the way up to something that we could experience as a belief. And we understand that people have different opinions about X, Y, and Z. But it goes all the way down to very low level sensory processing. You know, we are generating predictions and seeing the world, you know, much of what we see and we think is just black and white, solid or gas in front of us is an interpretation based on incomplete data, you know, based on our mental model of the world.
You have a story in the book about the guy walking the goats.
Oh my gosh.
This is so hilarious. Yes.
Tell us. So I, you know, during the pandemic, I survived by walking my dogs every day. And, you know, and I know all different kinds of breeds. I know specific dogs and their owners. And, you know, I know what times of day these people walk by. And so my brain needs very little information to recognize a dog at the end of someone's leash, right? It's something I can predict. And within like if you were to time me, I would guess that it would be 200 milliseconds between showing me a picture and me identifying what kind of a dog it is. And one day I was walking my dogs through this neighborhood and I saw a person with leashes, and on the end of their leashes were two goats. And I could feel the predictive processes of my brain because, you know, you know, that was a violation of the experience. And my brain was like, you could feel the glitch, right? Of like, what does not compute. And I was like, goats, this is so exciting. But that was all about prediction and context, right? Like I make the argument that if I had been driving in the neighborhood that I live in now and seen something behind a fence, I would probably be easier to recognize a goat than like a golden retriever, you know, out in a field. But that's a great example of how much we see the world through what we expect to see rather than what's actually there.
It's scary because then we start realizing that so much of what we believe to be real is not in fact real. It's something we have inferred or we have hallucinated into place. We've created, right. We've filled in the blanks in so many ways. And can you imagine a whole bunch of people doing this collectively, filling in the same blank? Then that becomes their reality and it's wild. I mean, you know, conspiracy theories and on the rest of it.
Right. I think I don't have to imagine that because that is where we live now, right? I think, you know, you were talking about technology and the human experience and I think this is the scariest thing for me about the future is that we interact with the world less and less and more with our technology. And our technology, you know, once upon a time, people who have different brains and different life experiences still had shared real world experiences to draw upon, whether it was like having a conversation at the mailbox or some kind of town hall meeting or, you know, pick up and drop off from school, the market, you know, and we could connect through some shared environment.
These we have agreed upon, like, this is real. This is real.
We're spending a lot more time. Imagine like charting a 12-hour day and how much time you spend in some physical space with other people versus in a digital space. And I think these digital spaces are increasingly tailored to what attracts our brains because our attention systems are marketable, right? So we don't, you know, when I was growing up, this dates me, but when I was growing up, everybody watched the same news channel, right? So we all saw these things happening and they weren't curated for us. They weren't interpreted for us. We then made up the stories and maybe made up different stories, but we saw the same stories.
Yeah.
And so if you think about what your brain is prepared for and what your experiences prepare you for, and that now I believe, you know, one of the things that scares me the most is that our smart devices are curating a world that they think our brains want to see, and that this brings us more and more and more apart. Our shared ground is less and less and less. Yep. And we become more and more and more entrenched and convinced that our truth is the truth. We have easy access to other people who think like we do, which reinforces this thing. And so our brains are more and more and more prepared. You were talking about entrenchment and you don't notice when things are actually different and you're moving around in the world out there. And that's what scares me, is because I think as human beings, we need to understand that we are, every single one of us is limited and finite, and we only have a part of the story, and we need to be able to relate with other people who have different points of view and understand where those points of view come from. Like, we evolved to solve problems in groups and to see the world in different ways and say, like, this is my family, this is a group. I don't, you know, agree with my brother or whatever, but it's really interesting that he pointed out the squirrel here when we were looking for this, you know, and to be able to relate to one another. I think we need to understand that our version of the truth has been curated.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of my big points. I talk about this like all the time. So it's so great to have you here talking about this and saying essentially the same, taking essentially the same position. You're a scientist. So brainwashing. I'm really interested because if our brains are so impressionable and so malleable, then brainwashing is something that is not just something that's done in controlled situations when you're trying to brainwash somebody, but we're constantly being brainwashed by whatever information we're receiving. And the more we receive a certain kind of information, the more our brains become to believe X, Y, and Z perhaps.
And our brains are a target. That's the thing that I think, you know, you were saying, do people understand their brains enough? No, like the average person doesn't understand their brain enough, but somebody who's targeting a misinformation campaign, they understand your brain and they understand what catches, and they understand what are the ingredients of something that will not only make an impression on you, but that you will want to then share and propagate through your other network of like-minded people. And so I think that, you know, it's like you need the user manual. You know, when I wrote the book, I was like, I want to give everyone the user manual to themselves.
Yes.
So that they can at least have as much knowledge as I do, somebody who's never met them in the world.
As the tech giants who are trying to own our brain, own our attention, market to us, control us, make us just pawns in their big marketing game.
Exactly.
Blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. Exactly.
We need our user manual. We need – so this is – this book and the work you're doing is user manual for humans as they navigate this tech-run future, this large language model controlled or mediated future, which only means that there's somebody behind the scenes who's controlling all of the information, every single thing we interact with, and they have an agenda. It's certainly not, I want you to be your best self, let me give you that information. No, it's, I want to control you because I want to make money. Or something, or whatever, or if it's a totalitarian government, I want to control you. I want to control what you believe, what you know to be fact, so I can control you as a human. So humans need to understand their brains are targets, and somebody's coming for it. And let's obviate that. Let's take control of our own brains. Let's understand what our brains are, how they work, and take control of them for ourselves, because that's what it means to be human.
Right. I agree. And I think, you know, in that narrative, I think that the scary part is like each of us is living our own unique life. The reason our brains are different is that the truth is, I think my truth is that your brain doesn't actually care about the truth. It cares about what works for you. Like every individual, we feel like we're motivated to understand some objective truth, but really the way we've evolved is to be successful based on cultural, biological definitions of success. And so our brains are looking for what works for us.
So and in survival. Nature, so ultimately, surviving and thriving is what this organism is targeted
doing.
On. Yes.
Right. And in nature, our brain, probably the thing that is most shared about every human brain is that they are learning machines. We're not born with a ton of instincts. We're born with a learning instinct. And so in nature, you know, from the time, like in the first 6 weeks of life, by the time an infant is 6 months old, they've shown a tuning towards the languages that they're exposed to. Like you're born being able to hear every spoken language in the world, but your brain is tuning into, in my environment, my individual lifespan, what is going to drive my success. And in nature, we would come up with as many different operational definitions of success as we do human beings. Like, your brain is looking for your definition of success based on your culture, your lived experiences, et cetera. I think that what happens in these tech information worlds is that there are few voices that are having this large influence and that are telling us what is success. So, yes. there's every path is different, but you're inheriting this mass idea, marketed idea of what success is. There's too few people defining what should be like a very individual path to wellness.
Yes. That's interesting because at different levels of the brain can be hijacked. So if some mm-hmm. external force can hijack that and then control not only the other aspect, your time, your focus, your attention, mm-hmm. but can control what you believe success is, mm-hmm. can really control.
And that's getting into
that's ultimate control.
That's right, because it's getting into your frontal lobe and the story that you use to organize information, right? So then it's going into the basal ganglia. The basal ganglia says, this is my goal. This is what I'm paying attention to. Turn up the volume, turn down the volume, right? And so, if I had a dream or a wish for people, it would be to get very honest about when do you feel good? Why? Why are you doing what you're doing? Who told you that is successful? And sort of taking back the reins on what works for you. Is this working for you? Because there are so many people I know that are just beating their heads against the wall because someone told them this works. Someone told them this is how you get successful. This is, the path. And they're like, I know I just have to do this 27,000 more times and the 28,000th time, I'm going to break through this thing. But
yeah. And one of the things I'm thinking about is the whole political conversations try to take control of that aspect of the human and say, I'm going to shape what you believe success is. So mm-hmm. whether it's like, have some, how you view your nationality, how you view your levels of patriotism or how you view very core aspects of what an individual believes is their identity and is satisfaction of their purpose in some that core way. And once you infiltrate that, then dark, twisted things can happen because people can, if you can convince a person to believe that their self-interest is in fact not their self-interest, but maybe your interest, then all sort of twisted things happen. I mean, this is how dictatorships and Nazism and it's evil things happened. It's how people like Hitler functioned mm-hmm. because they infiltrated that core concept of what it means to be a good person. German. What was a good German person was mm-hmm. X, Y, and Z. And they actually seduced people into believing that this is what they needed to do. Of course, there are all sorts of other things that went along with it. But if you can influence, if you can convince, if you can take control of that aspect of the person's brain, boy, oh boy, oh boy.
That's right.
Crazy.
And something that we know, again, so remember that like without a goal, if you're just moving through the world and you're in a flow state or you're just sensing and responding, which humans rarely do, we're capable of it, but we rarely do, our brain has these old evolutionary reasons for noticing and prioritizing and figuring out what to respond to. Mm. With a goal, or an idea of success, the brain changes and shapes these things, changes your input, changes your senses, reorganizes the world to help you be successful. But what is probably true and what I believe to be very true is that not all goals are created equally. There are some goals that are like, pay the bills or whatever, that you're not so invested in that you reorganize the world around those. Yeah. But identity, you use this word about identity and politics and so forth and so on. But I think it's important to note that our identity-based goals are probably the most protected in our frontal lobes because this, again, as a social creature, like belongingness, mm-hmm. group participation is a life or death in these, in our older in the ways that our brains evolved. And so
yeah.
if you're faced with a new piece of information that challenges some identity related yeah. belief, again, your brain is not actually, and this is all of our brains. So get to the place where you're not just like, oh, them, the others yeah. believe yeah. this, but like all of us, when we are faced with something that's inconsistent with our beliefs, we're very yeah. motivated to maintain our identity.
Yeah. yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so we're not gonna be motivated intrinsically. That doesn't mean we can't become aware yeah. and use that as a growth opportunity to go, I'm gonna go looking for things that challenge my identity-based beliefs.
So focus is a very big topic in the book. You have a whole chapter where you talk about focus. Our brains are engineered differently. Different internal signals are competing to run the show. Mm-hmm. There are two kinds of attention mechanisms, automatic and controlled. And then you use the horse rider metaphor. Okay, so tell us about this. Like, what's going on with focus and what are these two mechanisms and how can we understand them, in understanding them, better understand how to use our brains?
Yeah. So I think one of the, when it comes to attention and paying attention, the idea of focusing, I think one of the most underappreciated components of this system is that we are paying attention all the time, right? We are attending to something all the time. And the question is, are we seeing the world as it is and noticing things that are novel or unexpected? Or are we filtering the world through what we have decided is important for the task? So we've been talking about this throughout this conversation in yeah. different ways. We've been yeah. talking about the CEO or the governor of the brain and the frontal lobes and our identity-based goals. But I think the problem is that we decide that like something like ADHD or an organically driven brain, people who are less able to see the world through their goals, to filter their goals, and are more driven to quote unquote distraction based on what's happening around them, that we think that's bad. And I think that you should note that if we all completely filtered the world according to our goals, we would be eaten by tigers or things that we were not expecting to happen or that were not like on our to-do list or so forth and so on, right? So we need to balance seeing the world as it actually is in unexpected and interesting ways and filtering the world through our plans, goals, and objectives. And this is this horse and rider metaphor. You know, most behaving animals in the world learn that certain signals are more important for success, and they learn to notice novelty and they sense the world as it is more or less and behave according to plan. Humans can add these layers of story, beliefs, goals, and use that to guide what we focus on, how we pay attention to information. And both things are important and both things are necessary. And some people are more sort of internally goal-driven. Some people are more organically, you know, nature-driven. And it's really the kind of jobs that we ask our brains to do that set us up for success or failure. If we're asking our brains to sit at a desk still and focus on what's in a book, which is not very necessarily engaging, then having an organically driven brain might be really challenging. But if you're, you know, manning a radar scene or, you know, air traffic control, and you need to be like sensing what's going on in the world and adapting dynamically, then having a more organically driven brain can be really beneficial. And so I think that attention as the coin of the realm and the way that our understanding the way that our devices decide what kind of brain you have. I mean, they're so advanced. It's not only yeah. when you click, it's when you slow down over something, you know, it knows, yeah. it just knows what yep. grabs your attention. The smart devices know both. They know what you believe, what your identity is. They know if you like puppies or kittens better. They know, you know, and they know how to show a picture of a kitten to get you into these identity-based beliefs. And they use both. So that's how it's so powerful. And I just think it would be exciting if educators, coaches, and therapists understood the brains that were in front of them as Ooh. Well as our devices did. Because really, yes. that's the secret sauce, is like motivating,
yes.
bringing along, and then having that engaged, excited, curious brain be fed something that's actually going to help them. that have the person decide what goes in next, right?
So let's say we have, in the metaphor, you talk about the horse and the rider, and the horse is the brain that's sort of aware of what's happening around it. All the information is coming in. The rider's like, I want to get to that particular point. I'm focused on that. Right? Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. basic. Mm-hmm. So let's say we were very horse brain, horse dominant. We're like, oh, I'm distracted by everything. Every little YouTube video that pops up, I'll just go watch it instead of doing my work. Mm-hmm. Let's say we wanted to become more rider dominant, be more focused on the goal and then the longer term things, not the immediate. Can we train our brain to be more dominant, less horse dominant, more rider dominant, so to speak?
So the trick with that, yes. So practice always makes something better, more efficient or more available, right? Mm. The trick is to know that the rider is always more expensive energetically.
It's easy to be horse brain, but harder, takes more energy to be rider brain.
That's exactly right. So the rider is never going to be the default. It's never going to be the default because the horse can process more information at once. Uh-oh. Effortlessly. So in truth, if you want to be more controlled and more rider focused, what you need to do is maximize your energetically expensive brain for success. It's like sleep, nutrition, exercise, everything that's good for the body helps that rider to have more energy to do the things it needs to do. So that's number one. And number two is just to understand that because that kind of attentional focus is expensive, that you need to, you know, you can't control all the things all the time. So that's where like mindfulness and prioritization and setting intentions for the day, like this is the thing that's most important for me, because you might be using that rider part of the brain to like obsess about something you have no control over, or, you know, like, so I think being really understanding that there are a limited amount of goals that you can use to drive your behavior at any given time, that it's energetically expensive, and am I doing what I want to be doing? Especially like what I find myself doing is like, if I'm up, it's sometimes it feels convenient to worry about what other people are doing wrong then instead of like fixing your own self. And that is a controlled rider. When you're watching someone and judging them and thinking, oh, that person makes bad mistakes, if only they did this, this, and that, you're using that energetic demand to like fix or think about fixing someone else rather than applying it to yourself. So I think, you know, that's a place where I find easy access to
smart.
Me just ride my own brain and not, you know, that other, this more convenient, far away case study.
That is massively useful. Super interesting. I love it. Okay. Adapt was a chapter that I found was really interesting. And because we're at a time when we need to become more adaptable as humans, we are in this time of exponential change. And first of all, brains don't understand exponential change. I think they understand linear change and incremental. But exponential change is this driven by digital technologies. This crazy stuff's happening. And I see people, like most of the global population, are just sort of sitting by blasé. Meanwhile, the world's completely gone. And the smarter ones are just like in terror. So we need to become way more adaptable. You write that the brains of modern humans were selected for their ability to learn and adapt to changing environments. So we are adaptable. But now we have to be exponentially adaptable. Is that possible?
With limits, right? There are hard limits. Again, it's like when, unlike a computer, in order for change to happen in our brain, we're literally growing new proteins or cannibalizing pathways that we don't need. There's a biological, physical change that has to happen and keep pace with the information that we're trying to take in. So we're bounded. We're energetically bounded. We're, you know, locationally bounded. Our brain cannot grow outside of our skull. And so I think we can change on different levels. So again, it's like, is this a change at the perceptual level? Is this a change at the conceptual level? And I think at these highest meaning-making levels, we can hope to change our awareness. and by virtue our behavior, but we're not going to be able to keep up with everything. You know, we're going to have to make informed choices about where we adapt and what we adapt to.
We do have this capacity to see beyond. We have vision.
Right.
We have this incredible capacity to know and understand and adapt. Mm-hmm. So our adaptability can adapt to new rates of adaptability.
Reality.
We have to. And if one trait that's human is this capacity, then we know that from history, we've done it before. And now we need to do it again, regardless of what we face. We have this ability to adapt. We just maybe don't know what it looks like or what we will become, but we will become something in order to survive amidst the threat of machines.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have the capacity to be proactive and not reactive too. And we don't always, again, going back to the horse and rider, we don't always use that capacity, because being proactive, like doing something now in anticipation,
getting ahead of
yeah. the future it's expensive, right? You're right. Taking a gamble.
Yeah.
On the future turning out this way, and I'm spending time and control now, but we have that capacity to be proactive instead of reactive, like everything's on fire, I'm going to put it out.
Yeah.
And we differ. Different people are more proactive by nature than others. But I think that this is what we need to do. I mean, I think this is what we need to do in order to be okay, is to say, I'm going to make changes now to avoid this, you know, however you see yourself as a trajectory. If you see yourself as a trajectory and you don't like where it's going, spend the time and energy now to be proactive about behavior change, which is hard. It's very hard. It's easier to say than do.
But it's the people who do it are going to be way ahead of the game. It's like you have got to step away from the things that are sucking your attention in the day to day and start thinking in a much different way about your life in general, because the things you factored in determining your current trajectory have all changed, and you need to be on an entirely different path. And that starts with how you're thinking and what you're thinking, what you're looking at. And so many of the forces that people need to consider are invisible, which is why I say you have to understand these technologies and what's really behind them and how they really play out, and what you're seeing, what you think you know is not what it is at all. And the worst part is there are humans behind the scenes pulling the strings, and people, they like to talk about AI as if it's a thing and it has a mind of its own and there's going to be a singularity. No. I mean, like,
doing what it's designed to do.
They're just people trying to do this, take over the world, control everything. And it's not funny. It's not. I think for those of us who care about humanity, we know that it's high stakes game and we're just not going to have, we don't like it. It's just not. We know it's evil and we know what people will do with power. And that's all that's happening. Let's talk about curiosity, which is vital if we are to keep learning and keep up with change. Mm-hmm. How important is curiosity? I mean, I think it's a vital trait for survival in the 21st century. What is curiosity? Can we develop curiosity? Can we become more curious?
This is such a wonderful question. And I think this was the most exciting part of one of the most exciting things I learned to write the book was about curiosity research. And like, I think very few people would say, oh, curiosity is a bad trait. Although we do know that curiosity killed the cat and that there is some cost to curiosity. But few people realize that what are the sort of preconditions to set up and support curiosity, and that the brain gives us answers for those. So one of the things that made me feel proud to be a human that I learned when I read, when I was doing research for my book, is that the human brain treats information rewards in a virtually identical way to the ways it treats more primary rewards. Like if you put a hungry student or hungry subject into the scanner and show them pictures of food, their brains respond with this anticipation for rewards in the same area, in the same degree that if you give a curious person a trivia question and ask them how excited are they to find the answer, they anticipate the answer to that question in the same way, with dopamine, with our reward systems on board. And what's cool about that is that dopamine, we think of dopamine as this pleasure chemical, but really what it is it's a motivating chemical. It's something that triggers a learning event. Like your brain says, oh, there's something good in the future. We need to remember everything we did to get to this point. It creates this cascade of neuroplasticity that acts such that if you are curious and then you get a piece of information, you're much more likely to remember it than if you encounter that information and you weren't in a curious state. So I love that. I love that our human brain treats information as a primary reward. But there's the catch, and that's the curiosity killing the cat thing. So curiosity is triggered by, first, some situation you encounter where you don't know the answer. Right. So your previous model, your predictions, your expectations of what should be going on are violated. And this is uncomfortable in many circumstances. Initially, you find yourself not knowing what to do. You feel uncomfortable. We like to know what to do. We like to be able to predict the future. So before your brain gives you the feeling of curiosity, it first assesses safety. Am I safe to explore? And you can imagine this. You make a wrong turn in your car in a neighborhood, and you either think, oh, this is so cute, I want to look and see what's here, or, ooh, I don't know this place, it's dark, or whatever it's an unfamiliar street, there aren't a lot of people around, whatever it is that your brain goes through to like assess, it's safe, I want to get out of my car and explore, or I want to keep driving. It does with information as well. So before you feel curious, that subjective feeling of curiosity
requires a feeling of safety before that. So safety, then you allow yourself to be curious.
Right. So if you don't, if you think, oh, I don't care about that, I'm not curious about that, that may be because your brain feels some level of threat. And again, to identity, like psychological safety, I think is what we find when we're in front of new information. And so, we know, like, I can't tell you how many times I've heard someone say, how do you change someone's mind? And I think, well, your approach, you know, you have to, if you're trying to insert your view on another person, you're already in the wrong place, right? Because they're not curious and you can fact them to death and their brains may be turning down that information. But I think if you approach a conversation with somebody who believes differently than you and you're willing to change your own mind, you're literally in that space where instead of saying, how do I convince them that they're wrong? You're saying, I'm trying to understand where they're coming from. And you can get into this question. You can create question asking space. You may create the situation of curiosity where you can both learn something about each other's perspective.
That's high level. That's amazing. That's genius. I love it. So how do we become more curious? I think curiosity is important. I'm a very curious person. I'm like crazy curious. I'm like a child, like running around. Oh, what's that? What's that? What's that? I want to know. If I don't, I'm watching a movie and there's some trivia about the actor. I'm like, who's that actor? What do they know? I'm going to be on my phone, like checking them out and, oh, remember they did so-and-so film with so-and-so? What was that again? And I want to know everything all the time. And I really like that about myself. I will go into a new field and like, okay, I'll take 3 weeks and I'll take this field down. I will know everything about everything about everything. That's just a core aspect of who I am. I think it served me incredibly well throughout my life. It's probably one of the most valuable traits that I have. And I think it's something that if I could foster it in other people, I'd be like, please be more curious. It's going to be worth its weight in gold. Like whatever you're curious, it's worth it. How can people be more curious? I think as we navigate this very different world and have to understand technology and have to understand all these other forces that are at play and have to change what we do and change what our skill sets and change maybe professions, how can they like amp up curiosity?
Yeah. So the reason that curiosity comes at the end of my book is that I hope to have spent all of these chapters explaining to people that we each move through the world with different sense-making systems. And I think like the first step to making people more curious is to relax your assumptions that you're right. Because again, like nobody sees a trivia question that they think they know the answer to and feels curious about it. So I think step one is saying like what I know or what I think I know. That's why when we were talking earlier, I was like, I believe this to be true based on my lived experiences, but I'm always like, I could be wrong about everything. Yeah. So I think the step one is just sort of like relaxing your assumptions that your truth is the truth or that you know. Because if you think you know the answer, you will not be curious. So expanding your appreciation for the uncertain, I think is number one. And then the other piece is about like psychological safety and being judgmental about people with different perspectives. And I think we need to be aware of where our information is coming from and like aware of how like source and what this might be preparing us for. But at the same time, I think that if you look at a new piece of information with the lens of what might I be missing, I think that that can foster curiosity. And I think that importantly, it's like we can have two different opinions and we can both be right.
Like it's going to be true. Yes.
Two things can be true for us based on our lived experiences, based on our environments. Like, you know, and again, going back to that, my brain is defining my success based on my little, you know, my slice of life. And this is why I think like I saw Barbara Kingsolver, who wrote Demon Copperhead and a lot of books that I love. I saw her speak and she said, don't stop reading fiction. Don't think that just because it's not real, it's not important. I think even like sometimes it can be easier to be curious about a fictional character and reading about somebody with a very different life than your own can expose you to like a whole other life of experiences. And we can empathize and get into those spaces without feeling judgmental. And so I think just questioning what we know and being secure that that doesn't mean we're wrong or bad or whatever, but that we might be missing something from somebody else's perspective, questioning where information comes from and what it's preparing us for. I think that, you know, these are things that that can help expand curiosity. And then there's the part about moving through discomfort, you know, because we feel better when we think the future is predictable. That's always been a lie. I mean, the future has never been predictable, but COVID and, you know, the changing times now have, if you haven't gotten to that place that predicting the future is a lie we tell ourselves to be comfortable, then I think, you know, that's a great place to say, hey, I need to be comfortable in the uncomfortable and I'm going to expose myself to some uncomfortable.
Yeah, I love it. So good. So good. You had me like so thinking about how are we going to be within ourselves, within our organism as we navigate forward. We need to change that, how we relate to ourselves. And consequently, how we relate to, or how we permit ourselves to relate to things outside of us, whether it's information, ideas, beliefs, people, and how we filter that. And I think the more secure we are within ourselves, the more open we are to other possibilities outside of us.
That's right.
Or how we interpret what we're getting. And the more open we are in a changing terrain, exponentially changing terrain, the more capable we are of responding not to what we believe or thought it should be based on the past, but now because we're so centered within ourselves, our relationship with ourselves is stronger and healthier, more powerful, we can now actually take in the information of all this change and then deal with it.
Mm-hmm. That beautifully said. Yes.
So while you were talking, I was just like, oh, I could feel that difference that we had to be in order to become this creature that can deal with this exponentially changing world. And actually that is a conversation I want to continue because I think we need to do something about it. That's a big topic. Okay. So all this leads us to you have this beautiful chapter called Connect, which is where you end the book, how two brains get on the same wavelength, which is so sexy. So something that really stood out for me was people don't really see another person. They see the patterns that that person evokes in their brain.
That's right. That's right. We see each other, like our automatic way of understanding others is through a mirror. Even like in language, when we're listening to speech sounds, our brain is activating the motor plan to make that speech sound. And that helps us understand what we're hearing.
Right.
And I think that this wild and adaptive social learning mechanism works really well when the person you're trying to understand actually works like you do.
Yeah.
Right? You get it right and you connect more easily with someone whose brain is, the brain that's driving the behavior works like yours. So when you reverse engineer them, you have a sense of what's creating their behavior. And that's, you know, that's another thing I learned when writing the book is this idea that brains of a feather flock together. Yeah. And this increasing field of social neuroscience that shows that you can predict whether people will be friends as long as they live close enough to one another to come into physical contact. Similarity in brain responses predicts friendship above personality type, age, gender, all these other demographics that you think might be important. We like people whose brains work like ours, I believe, because we feel like we understand them.
Okay, but your husband.
Right.
He has a brain that doesn't work like yours.
Thankfully, because we'd probably all be very inbred otherwise, evolution gives us this trick for our romantic partnerships or for our evolutionarily important relationships, also our children, right? Is oxytocin. So when you're in a like romantic pair bonding situation, your brain gives you oxytocin, which essentially motivates you to pay attention to social cues. It motivates you to work harder to understand what's going on in someone else. It turns up the reward value of social cues when you're in a romantic partnership or in a parent-child relationship. And so, you know, when I'm talking to others, I say there are other ways of understanding people. You can model another person's mind in the same way you would model quantum physics or something like that. You can imagine it. You can build a representation based on your knowledge of how different people work. It's energetically demanding and it's expensive. And so that gets you to the question of what would motivate you to do that. Oxytocin motivates you to do that for your social, you know, your sort of evolutionarily important relationships. But you might not feel that way about somebody you're on a team with at work or, you know, somebody you get paired with in a class experience or something like that. So that's where you have to rely on curiosity. I think curiosity is the secret sauce to motivating you to understand somebody who doesn't work like you. Like, this is a thought experiment. Like, what is going on in Misha's brain?
So you and your husband have same worldview, same interests, right? Same, you're on the same trajectory in terms of what you want to do in the world. And it's a massive sort of, I think, force for bringing people together.
Exactly.
But your brains work differently.
Exactly. Yes. So, very much so.
So brains of a feather flock together, but also people who have similar interests or goals or worldviews can flock together.
That's right. If you have a shared motivation to do something, right?
Which is more powerful?
I don't think we know the answer to that because of the nature of these experiments, right? So the way that these things work, they're looking for people moving around in the wild and for energy how you spend energy. So like in the wild, I think many of us don't move around looking for friends that are expensive in terms of like getting to know them, right? We're looking for someone who we feel we get something from an easy way.
Yeah.
But when we're looking to partner with somebody who can help us accomplish a goal, then we might be looking for someone who's complementary to our own skills, right? And so, I think that's why it works really well on teams to have people who don't work the same.
So really important skill set, if we are to solve 21st century challenges, is being able to create teams with diverse brains, diverse perspectives, and diverse approaches in how they perceive things and how they respond to things and how they deal with things. And how do you build a great team?
Oh my gosh. I talk about this in the Connect chapter as well. There's some really cool research happening at Carnegie Mellon. I think the last name is Woollett or Woolley. I can't remember exactly, but she's doing fascinating work looking at what she calls collective intelligence of teams. So you can take a group of people, just like you can take a single person and measure their skills on a lot of different kinds of tasks. You can take a team and give them a lot of different tasks, and certain teams outperform other teams on all the different tasks. And that's what she calls collective intelligence. And that's what you're asking, like, what's a good team? Well, I think collective intelligence, a team that's successful in a lot of different ways, is a good way to operationalize this. And what she found was that the performance of teams doesn't have anything to do with the intelligence of any individual, the average intelligence, the maximum intelligence, but instead in people's ability to reverse engineer one another, to understand theory of mind, or to connect with other people's sort of internal workings on the team. This was the number one of the top predictors. The other one was turn taking. So if the team is dominated by one voice, it's not going to have high general intelligence. And she also found that the number of females on a team was predictive of its overall success, which is correlated in her group, which she had a couple thousand people across these different studies, with both turn-taking and the ability to reverse engineer one another. So again, the collective intelligence is not about any individual or average intelligence, but about your ability to see one another and to share the responsibility and kind of decision-making.
That's amazing. Wow. Okay. So delicious. Okay. In your research for the book and in your work in general, what surprised or surprises you?
I think I'll talk about, I talked about a lot of the things I love about my book, and I'm happy to have had that opportunity. Something that surprises me that I'm working on now. So after spending 25 years trying to understand how different facets of brain function shape learning, shape success in learning in different environments, what I'm coming to realize is that your own subjective ideas about yourself, this kind of layer of interpretation that you add to your previous experiences, are often a stronger predictor of your success than your biological capability. So let's say I can put 20 people bring them into the lab and record their brain activity in one way or another, and that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this kind of brain activity is really indicative of success in natural language learning or learning programming languages or whatever it is that I'm trying to accomplish. And then I can just ask you, like, do you think you're good at learning natural languages? Do you think you're good at learning programming? And that this idea of how you believe your future success is going to be, or how you think you learn, kind of can counteract or bolster your biological predispositions. And that's because, number one, if your brain predicts future success, you're going to get that dopamine. And not only does that actually facilitate plasticity and rewiring, it motivates you. Like, many of the desirable skills that we want are hard. And if you get into it and it's hard and you tell yourself it's hard because I'm not good at it, this is kind of like the biology of the growth mindset, right? If you say this is hard because I'm bad, you're not motivated, you get no dopamine, and you make different choices about whether to persist and try harder or not. And so, you know, this is where I'm working now, is to like teach people to see themselves as they are, to partner with their brains, as you started this conversation, to re-examine their stories about their own learning in a way that empowers them to achieve the future success that they want to achieve.
Yeah, I love it. I love it, love it, love it. I'll talk to you about it in a second when we wrap up. What's one thing that listeners can take from this, just one thing, to become more ready for the future? And that's in addition to getting the book and following your work and the studies, but what's something they can do in their everyday life after listening to this conversation that will set them up for being more prepared for whatever comes next?
I think I think we need to be responsible about the information that we're feeding our brains, to understand that your brain is not experiencing the whole entire world, but that whether it's the shows you're watching on Netflix or the news that you're reading or whatever, like everything, every experience or the things you worry about or the things you daydream about, every experience is feeding your brain, and your brain is taking that as information that it needs to use to prepare for your future. And so to be prepared for the future, I think you really need to say, in this experience that I'm feeding my brain, what am I actually preparing for? Is it the world that I want to be successful in? Is it the world that I operate in right now? And so I would just say, try to feed yourself experiences that are representative of where and how you want to thrive, and be responsible. If you're feeding your brain a lot of bad news, a lot of scary things, a lot of non-representative points of view, that is the world that you're preparing to operate in.
That's brilliant. Okay. So what's next for you? So you're working on something new now. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I just got a new grant with the Office of Naval Research, where we're looking at self-knowledge training. And rather than teaching people a specific skill that they want to learn, I'm teaching people about themselves, how they learn. And so they can, again, re-examine the assumptions about themselves and their own learning. And they can kind of take the wheel of, you know, we talked about the user manual. I'm trying to give learners the user manual to their own learning styles and see if we can increase both confidence, you know, how they report seeing themselves as successful, and competence, right? So not just how much do you think you're going to succeed in this field, but like, how do they actually perform? Looking at measures of persistence and engagement and confidence, you know, like I think the confidence change along with the performance change is really important. So I'm excited to do that. I'm brainstorming ideas for book number two that are really centered on this, like this idea of understanding yourself as a trajectory and understanding change, not only how we're different from one another, but how we differ on a millisecond by millisecond basis and a decade by decade basis, and how to identify as yourself as a trajectory and not a point in time.
So good.
And those are two things that I'm really, really excited about, just letting people understand how they work and where they're going.
I love it. Anything else we should have touched on?
I just want to thank you for your passion and for the time that you spend to help people get ready for the future.
Well, thanks for coming on. This is amazing. I can't wait to have you back.
Make sure to listen, follow, and subscribe for new episodes wherever you get your podcasts and on our YouTube channel.